Martin Cohen is a professor of political science at James Madison University, and he is the author of The Party Decides and Moral Victories in the Battle for Congress. Here's Martin Cohen. You're listening to Dunk Tank. All right. I am here with Professor Martin Cohen. Sir, thank you so much for joining me today.
Yeah, thanks for having me.
So you've done important research in a number of different areas, but I had first heard about you because you had co-written an influential book called The Party Decides. But before we talk about the debate around the book, let's talk about the claims that were actually made in there. The book starts with the nomination of Hubert Humphrey in 1968. Could you talk a little bit about that? I mean, what does that event tell us about the nomination of major party candidates?
Well, it was sort of emblematic of a system that had become corrupted and had been seen as increasingly illegitimate. And it kind of all blew up in Chicago in 1968 with that controversial convention where the party was split on the Vietnam War. There were protests and riots in the streets, violence broadcast to the entire nation. And because of Robert Kennedy's assassination in June and Eugene McCarthy's strong pacifist stand on the war, Democratic leaders were looking for someone else to be their standard bearer. And they settled on the vice president, Hubert Humphrey, who had not won any of the primaries or caucuses that had been contested by other candidates such as McCarthy and Kennedy.
Right. So basically he hadn't gone into any of the primaries and caucuses, and yet he still was drafted on the first ballot.
Yes.
Okay. So there was some reform of the process, right? I mean, it was called like the McGovern-Fraser reforms. What were those reforms? Did they have any effect?
Yeah, they completely changed the nominating system. They were Democratic Party reforms that the Republican Party largely jumped onto and instituted themselves in different ways. But essentially, it made the delegate selection process much more transparent and much more tied to the results of the state primaries and caucuses. And the selection process made it so that you had to enter primaries and caucuses in order to gain delegates that you would have pledged to you at the national convention, and that was how you got nominated. So it changed things dramatically, very quickly, and only a select few candidates sort of caught on to the new system, one of which being one of the members of the commission, one of the founding members of the commission, George McGovern, who got the Democratic nomination in the next time around in 1972.
And he was not, George McGovern was not the selection of party insiders, correct?
Right. He would not have been their top choice, certainly. And the sort of party favorite that time around was Ed Muskie. Humphrey also wanted the nomination again, but continued to sort of play by the old rules and not entering any of the early primaries. McGovern simply, you know, knew that you had to be campaigning everywhere, and his story is one that is, you know, a story of someone coming sort of out of nowhere and capitalizing on some momentum to win a very fractured primary campaign.
Would it be fair to say that this was a point when the influence of the smoke-filled rooms, at least in the Democratic Party, started to decline? Or was McGovern sort of an anomaly?
No, I mean, I think in the Democratic Party and then later on in the Republican Party, too, because Republicans went to primaries as well, I think that the smoke-filled rooms of the convention was a point where it was too late to deliberate then and too late to decide then. The nomination had already been clinched or would already be clinched before the convention, so those convention smoke-filled rooms were sort of rendered meaningless after the candidates had already gotten a majority of the delegates during the primary process.
So what about today? I know that after 2016, some people look back at this book and say that, clearly Trump was not selected by party insiders, and Bernie Sanders almost made it over the top. What effect do you think 2016 had on the thesis of this book? Did it change your mind at all, or your understanding?
Well, even in the short period between publication, which was 2008, and 2016, we were already starting to see a little bit of some cracks in the system that we described. And we think we accurately described for the 20 or 30 years in which, we really focused on. But things started to change in 2004 with Howard Dean's campaign. And 2008 on the Republican side was not, a clear-cut victory for our theory. And obviously with Trump, it sort of all seemingly fell apart. But we think of 2016 as sort of the culmination of a series of changes that have taken place that have sort of shifted the dynamics that we're not sure if it's made our theory, obsolete, or the parties will begin to adjust. But there certainly have been some fundamental changes to the way we nominate our presidents, even in the short period of time, like I said, between publication and the current time period.
You mentioned 2004 with Howard Dean, and when you talk about these changes to the nominating process, how much of this is just things like the rise of the internet?
Well, certainly the rise of the internet, the increased visibility of the invisible primary, because we argue that in the book that, the party leaders and elites who used to decide at the convention pushed that process forward to the invisible primary stage and did a lot of deliberating themselves. And we sort of measure this deliberation by their endorsements of candidates, public endorsements that signal who the party is for. But the invisible primary has become quite visible with the increase in media coverage. Social media has allowed voters to weigh in on the invisible primary process, where in the past they were not, paying attention and certainly not, impacting party elites at that time before the votes were even counted. So there's that. And there's also the flood of early money that is coming into the system that used to be money was a resource that party leaders, could dole out and keep from candidates they didn't want to be successful. So early money, the visibility of the invisible primary, the rise of social media, are among the changes that have threatened the party elite's control over the process.
It seems, though, like the party elite's control over the process is stronger on the Democratic side, because after all, Bernie Sanders came close, but he didn't make it all the way, and it seems to be pretty clear that there were efforts by party insiders to stop him and that were at least partly successful. Do you see any major differences in the two parties where you, was it just a fluke that the party elites got to decide on the Democratic side, at least in 2016? Or do you think there's something more institutional that caused that?
I would say, a lot of it is determined by the level of factional disputes within the party. And it just so happens that now, or at least in 2012, 2016, especially 2016, the Republicans just had a lot more factional interplay. The rise of the Tea Party, the revolt against John Boehner in the years leading up to 2016. And then, of course, Donald Trump's skillful use of wedge issues within the party, like trade and immigration, really made it very difficult for the party to unite. And there was not a obvious focal point for them to unite around. And, yes, they did not want Trump, but they couldn't figure out who they wanted instead. And that proved to be a fatal blow to their chances of controlling the process. So I don't think that right now we can say that one party is more or less likely to be able to control. I think, you know, you're looking at the Democratic Party now with a similar amount of candidates and a similar level of factional dispute, although I still think the Democrats are ideologically more coherent right now than the Republicans are.
Really? Well, why do you think that? It seems like at least the Republican Party is pretty fairly well lined up behind Trump. It seems like maybe there's more disputes between like the left and the center left on the Democratic side.
Yeah, I mean, ideologically speaking, I just think that there are more factions that have stronger bases of support within the Republican Party. That you take away Trump and his unifying presence, and I think, you know, it's a up for grabs again. You know, let's say in 2024, with Trump off the scene, regardless. I think the Democratic, you know, party ideologically, you know, just I don't see the left as having as much strength and pull as the right does on the Republican side.
Okay, so what about for non-presidential nominees, people competing for the House and Senate or even state races? Do the smoke-filled rooms have a stronger grip on the nominating process down the ballot?
I think the lack of visibility of congressional primaries and primaries even below that, the state level, gives party leaders ample opportunity to impact those races still. And, you know, primarily, you know, we talk about intense policy demanders as being sort of the focus of party activity. And these are ideological, they are elected officials, they're interest group leaders, and other group leaders. And we feel that they control the party through nominations and through, in some cases, denomination or the threat of denomination of a candidate who is not following the party agenda. And so we look at nominations as central to our theory of parties in other work, as well as in The Party Decides. And at the congressional level, you know, it doesn't take a lot to sort of put your thumb on the scales in favor of a preferred candidate. And if you would argue at the presidential level that the visibility of the process has gone sky high, that hasn't been the case at the congressional level. So I think there's still the opportunity to deliberate amongst the party factions and amongst the intense policy demanders, and then find a suitable candidate to sort of get behind and shepherd through the primary and then, of course, into the general election.
I don't know how much you've written or studied the, and maybe it's hard while it's still going on, but the current Democratic primary, do you see, you know, you have people like Deval Patrick and Michael Bloomberg entering the race very late, it seemingly encouraged by party elites, worried that there's no clear candidate who can win against Trump. Can you speak at all about the influence of party elites deciding the nominating contest for the Democrats this time around?
Well, it is a bit difficult in the middle of it. And, you know, we're about 50 or so days, maybe less, to Iowa. And, you know, by the time Iowa comes around, if nothing, you know, drastic happens, Joe Biden's going to have a pretty comfortable lead in the endorsement derby. And he's going to have a nice breadth of endorsements that other candidates don't have. So, you know, there is some coalescing around Biden. It's not nearly what it was for Hillary in 2016, of course, and for other past frontrunners. But, you know, especially with Kamala Harris dropping out and some of her support maybe going to Biden, he's going to be a strong, relatively strong front runner. And the question is that enough? And, you know, to the extent the party has made a decision, you know, is that going to get Biden through the contest that he'll have, you know, strong competition in?
Do you have a value judgment on this, though? I mean, do you believe that our democracy is healthier without these sort of smoke-filled rooms deciding the nominee, or do you think that, you know, we're all better off if people sort of decide for and let's just, you know, vote?
Well, I think, you know, peer review is a nice, you know, goal. And, you know, professional political operatives, people who, you know, are better than the average person at taking the measure of a candidate, I think should have a role and play a role, and not the entire role, but some hybrid where you have some peer review, some, you know, way for the party to, you know, say who is acceptable, and then the voters to, you know, maybe pick between two that are acceptable, or, you know, or at least have the ability to know what the party wants and what the leaders want. You know, I don't think we should go back to the conventions where, you know, it was decided just there and no voter input, because certainly there were some bad candidates nominated by party elites. But I think on balance, you know, you're much more likely to get a disastrous candidate when, you know, the voters are the ones who are deciding without a lot of guidance. And, you know, we saw Donald Trump, obviously, as, you know, what happens when the party doesn't decide. Certainly in the early stages of the post-McGovern era, Frazier era, McGovern and Carter, you know, were the Democratic nominees, and one was, you know, trounced in the general election, the other became president, but maybe an ineffective president, partly because he didn't have the relationships developed with party elites that other candidates might have had in an earlier system.
When you say the voters, I'm not sure. What do you base the idea of the voters perhaps being more likely to make a quote-unquote mistake in deciding the nominee than party elites, just because party elites have been around the block more? Or what is it exactly?
I think it's experience. You know, party elites, activists are, you know, usually have the opportunity to take the measure of the candidates and have more access to the candidates. We talk a lot in the book about, you know, these one-on-one gatherings, or, you know, a few people in a living room, you know, hearing the candidates, you know, getting to meet them and, you know, deliberating amongst themselves and, you know, throwing around the pros and cons of each candidate. And just that kind of deliberation would seem to lead to a better decision. And, you know, voters historically are not well informed. They don't know, you know, basic differences between the candidates on policy and for the most part. And they're deciding on the basis of other, maybe more superficial means. So in a general election, we know party identification is a big predictor. But obviously that cue is thrown out the window in nomination contests. And so what are the voters basing their decisions on? And I just think that party elites will have the experience. They've been around the block, as you said, but also they, you know, are more likely to have encountered these candidates either firsthand or secondhand or thirdhand. And it's not a commercial that they're watching on television. And that's, you know, Bloomberg's strategy is to, you know, pay, you know, spend $30 million a week and skip the first four contests and come in on Super Tuesday. And to me, you know, yeah, he might buy his way to the nomination, but it doesn't seem like the strategy for the Times.
In terms of people being around the block and things like that, one criticism that people might level against that is, well, two. One is that when party elites decided Hillary Clinton and people of the Republican Party decided Donald Trump, but also, is there anything about that that is potentially anti-democratic? The reason I ask is because a lot of people say, you know, political consultants and party elites, they'll go for a quote-unquote safe choice, like a moderate white guy in the Democratic Party, let's say. And they would argue that this is exclusionary of candidates who might not have the perceived features of electability that are based on past experience. Like, you know, party elites might have said in 2008 that Barack Obama can't possibly win because, you know, he's a black guy with the middle name of Hussein, and, you know, put him in a Midwestern state and he'll get crushed.
Yeah, I mean, definitely that would be, makes it harder to crack into, you know, sort of the, you know, whether it's still the old boy network or not. And in fact, you know, Barack Obama in 2007, you know, was not getting a lot of party support. People were sort of holding back, tentatively supporting Hillary. But then you put him in a Midwestern state like Iowa in the caucus, he wins it. And then the party says, okay, you know, he can do it. And they didn't have any problem moving towards him during the rest of the primary process. So I think you raise certainly good points about the anti-democratic nature of it. And yes, it's a little bit anti-democratic. But again, you know, professionals should have a say. And you know, when you go to get, you know, brain surgery, you want someone who's been around the block, as you put it, and not someone who is, you know, new to the process. And in any, you know, plumber, you want someone who's, you know, got experience. And we seem to, you know, with politicians, want, you know, someone new, someone who hasn't been there, someone who's not experienced. And it just seems like that's the one profession where we accept that and actually want that. And that seems to be odd to me.
Yeah, it's definitely weird that that's, I mean, it's almost like the worst thing you could do for your long-term political career right now would be to jump into Congress, because people would just say, you know, oh, you're an insider. That speaks to your point also about the idea of having a hybrid of, you know, people and elites making these decisions. You've also kind of make a transition here, because you've also written extensively about the rise of the religious right. Your most recent book, Moral Victories in the Battle for Congress. We've always had, you know, evangelicals and church revivals throughout the country. But when did they start going into politics?
Well, I mean, they were involved pretty heavily in politics up until the 1920s, and many people point, you know, to the Scopes Monkey Trial and the, you know, subsequent discrediting of William Jennings Bryan on the stand as sort of an event that forced or pushed fundamentalists, especially, out of politics and back to sort of just winning souls and being involved in spreading the gospel. And the sort of reemergence, and it's not that they were completely out of politics between that time and the 1970s, but sort of the reemergence is usually talked about as occurring in the mid to late 1970s surrounding several different issues, whether it's Roe versus Wade, whether it's the IRS, you know, attacking the so-called segregation academies, Christian schools that were open to keep African-American students out, or the Equal Rights Amendment or gay rights ordinances passed. This period of time was very, you know, where evangelicals became reactivated. And of course, there were some televangelists that led the way, Jerry Falwell, Pat Robertson, that started to insert themselves into politics. And the Republican Party, Republican operatives sort of felt that this was a base that could be ripe for the picking.
That's the ripe for the picking is kind of the operative phrase, because the Republican Party used to be pro-choice, right? I mean, so was this purely a cynical electoral play?
No, I don't think so. I think I look at it and you know, from my research, you know, I look at it as, you know, sort of the activists, you know, pushing their way into the party. And it happened at the local level, at state level, in counties, where evangelical Christians and fundamentalists, you know, saw that there was a party that, you know, was more like them. And it was the Republican Party, starting with Reagan. And once Carter, you know, was a born-again Christian himself, but governed like a liberal Democrat, Reagan appealed to them, and the Republican Party sort of then didn't necessarily, you know, it's a mix. It's a mixture of, you know, from the outside in, from the inside out. I don't think it was purely one or the other, but in some places, Republican elitists were very resistant to these Christian right activists, and they were felt affronted by them and attacked by them because they were invading their turf. And so it wasn't necessarily purely politically cynical, although for some, they realized that abortion was a wedge issue that could get evangelicals and pro-family Catholics to the Republican Party. But you know, a lot of it was done from the outside in and from the grassroots.
Why do you think Trump has such a lock on evangelicals? Because it used to be that evangelicals said, you know, very strongly in huge numbers that they would want a president who conducts himself in a moral, spiritual way on a personal level. But of course, Trump doesn't really seem to, even among his supporters, have that reputation. So what is it, do you think, makes evangelicals stick to him?
I mean, I think it's just become the tribal nature of our politics, the negative partisanship that's out there. And the worst Republican is better than the best Democrat for if you're a Republican voter. And evangelical Christians have proven to be the most solid core constituency of the Republican Party. And so they look at Trump, and he is the person standing in the way of democratic, liberal, secular takeover of America. And, you know, he's the perfect test case, Trump. Is if you could think of, you know, okay, if we could run an experiment to see how loyal the evangelical Christians are, let's give them a candidate like Donald Trump and see what they do. And what they did was they, you know, once he got the nomination and put out that list of judges, they went fully behind him and have stayed there more than any other group in the electorate. So it's a, you know, we now know that they are transactional, they are partisan, and really more than anything else, that's what they are supporting him for that reason. Now, go back to the nomination season, and then it becomes a little bit more complicated because there were other options for the evangelical Christians, better options for them. Rubio, Cruz, and others were potentially much better options. Now, Trump didn't dominate evangelicals during the primary season, but he did well enough that he got the nomination.
Okay, so that's... In this case, basically, once he's locked up the nomination, they're sticking with him out of, you know, tribal politics that affects all of us on some level. But I guess we should be also more precise. When we say evangelicals, what we really mean is white evangelicals, because there are plenty of non-white evangelicals who are not jumping aboard the Trump train. So how important is race here?
Well, very important. And you're right. We should be more precise and talk about, you know, you have to talk about race. But you do get, you know, certainly African-American evangelicals are, you know, like most African-Americans are solidly in the Democratic camp. However, you know, if you are an evangelical and you're a Democrat, you're probably African-American, and you are more socially conservative than the average Democrat. It doesn't affect your vote like it does for white evangelicals, but certainly race obviously is a defining factor in our politics. And, you know, again, I don't think it has to be either or, but some of Trump's support among white evangelicals certainly could have been, you know, an appeal to their, you know, whiteness more than their Christianity.
I had mentioned this in the email I sent to you, but we've had in this country this idea of manifest destiny, that God himself ordained Americans to spread across the continent. Do you see any between that and the almost deification of Donald Trump and this America First?
It's an interesting comparison. I think, you know, Trump is the strong leader that I think a certain type of voter craves. I think, you know, whether we talk about the authoritarian personality or we talk about, you know, different psychological characteristics that, you know, the need for the need to decrease ambiguity, the need for, you know, faith over reason. There's a lot that Trump brings to the table that appeals to evangelicals psychologically, white evangelicals psychologically. And I think the deification of him, the sort of divine hand of God, you know, I think it's justification. I think it's you know, you can't argue with that. And that's part of, you know, what's frustrating to many on the left is that, you know, you can't argue with, well, God ordained this.
You've talked about the celebrification of our politics, this notion that celebrities the idea of celebrity has taken over our politics. Is this a new trend?
I think it is not quite as new as people might think. Personally, I started to notice it in the early 90s when, you know, I was involved a little bit of politics and campaigns, and you started getting people, you know, wanting pictures with politicians. You know, not selfies back then, but, you know, normal pictures, and get autographs from politicians. And politicians like Bill Clinton started to go on MTV, and they started to go on Arsenio Hall, and I'm dating myself. But the point is that I think in the early 1990s, and the Clintons became celebrities. And right. I think that sort of was the beginning. And obviously we've gone to a whole nother level with that's the early 90s is the beginning of reality TV with MTV's The Real World. And, you know, as reality TV becomes a bigger part of our entertainment ecosystem, as politicians become, you know, as actors become politicians and politicians become media personalities and back and forth, there's another revolving door. The revolving door is between, you know, Hollywood and Washington. And I think the blend of information and entertainment has led to the culmination of, you know, the reality TV star becoming president of the United States without any political or military experience.
It's this kind of goes back to what you were saying earlier about voters making choices based on very superficial things. And I wanted to ask if you think this introduction of celebrity into the process, do you think the reason that this has taken hold among people is just because they look at these elections as being rigged or somehow illegitimate and, you know, catering to special interests? In other words, they look at the process itself as a reality show in the first place. So, you know, why not treat it like one?
Maybe. You know, we know that reality TV is pretty heavily scripted, or at least pretty heavily, you know, cut and edited. And there's a formula, and there's a way to be successful in these reality TV shows, and there's a way to be successful in politics. And, you know, right now there's a worrying, in my opinion, worrying fusion of the two. And again, it goes back to also, you know, this sort of denigration of experience, this this elevation of, a lack of experience. And, I think the combination has, worked in the same direction, and has produced, Donald Trump as, a president. I mean, it's really, take away all of the offensiveness of his communication and, all of the bad things he does. Just look at the absence of experience, the absence of any pedigree for leading the country, and that's, troublesome as enough as it is.
Last question before I let you go. Just based on what we've talked about here today, the celebrity and the evangelicals rising on the right, and smoke-filled rooms. I mean, do you have any reforms in mind that you think could be added to the nominating process that would make our democracy function a little better?
I think, there's two ways to go about, inserting or reinserting peer review. One would be to make it easier for the contest to go to the convention, to make it and make it more acceptable to have a brokered convention. And that would involve changing some of the delegate allocation rules. It would involve different motivations for candidates and incentives for candidates to stay in the race longer and prolong the process. So you could add it in the back end, like it used to be, only in cases where it was necessary, but it wouldn't be a disaster. It wouldn't be thought of as illegitimate if the convention had to decide at the end of this primary and caucus process. So that would be one way to do it. Another way would be to, in the pre-primary period, to have the party, make a couple endorsements or have an official sort of, process where they're saying, we accept or we feel these are the acceptable candidates. And, everyone else could run, but the party voters would at least have a queue. And, maybe now in our current age, that would be a detriment to a candidate. Wouldn't want that imprimatur of the party. But that might not be, something that lasts, for decades and decades. We might want to start, valuing experience again, and maybe we will after this, present era.
Well, on that note, Professor Martin Cohen, thank you very much for your time.
Thank you. I appreciate it. No problem.
Thank you to Martin Cohen, and thank you for listening to Dunk Tank. I'm Duncan Gammy. See you next time.